This is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. I'm Dean Becker. Our engineer is Steve Nolan. Tammy's here helping with the phones and the computers. In a few minutes, our guest for the evening here in the studio, Buford Terrell, professor of law at South Texas College of Law, will be here to join us. I just got some astounding news a couple of hours ago. Our guest will also include a gentleman whose very future is on the line for the medical marijuana community, noted author of so many wonderful books, Ed Rosenthal, who is now standing trial in federal court for providing medical marijuana to sick and dying people, as authorized and deputized to do so by the city of Oakland, California. Truth itself is on trial. Going to be a busy show, but first up, just a bit of drug war news. Since our last show, a major story has broken in Great Britain. Let's listen to their former drug czar, Mo Mollem.
From Great Britain, from the Guardian newspaper, the author is the former drug czar until 2001, Mo Mollem. Better drug laws will cut gun crime. Let's recognize reality and start selling this stuff at off licenses. Regulated, he's saying. He continues, we should remember that most gun crime relates to the illegal drugs trade, which is mainly controlled by foreign gangs for whom guns are a regular part of the business. Drug dealers have been shooting at each other for some time without the media and home office attention suddenly being lavished upon them. The increase in gun crime is a byproduct of the level of organized crime that we are allowing to fester within our society, an organized crime business that is being fueled by our wrong-headed laws relating to drugs. Drugs in this country are almost more freely available than alcohol. Their supply is not constrained by licensing laws. Large number of people smoke marijuana, particularly teenagers and young people, and a lot also take ecstasy and cocaine. They are not criminals. They are people you know. They are people who are likely to be sitting next to you at work or living in your homes. But all these people are being brought into almost daily contact with organized crime. Isn't this a most foolish situation? Mollem continues, let's start looking at how drugs can be legalized in our society. Let's realize reality and start to reduce the numbers who are cluttering up our prisons. Let's start selling drugs through outlets such as off licenses, where the likelihood of dealing with someone holding a gun is virtually zero, unlike the street traders of today. Let's admit that we are getting it wrong by allowing our fear and prejudice against certain drugs to drive us to pursue wrong-headed policies which only produce damaging social results. Again, the author, Mo Mollem, former drug czar of Great Britain.
Okay, I also got a chance this past weekend. I visited with a few folks at Houston's anti-war rally, and here's what they had to say on the subject.
Bernard, tell us what you think about Bush's oil war.
Well, I think it's very obvious that he's going in there just for the oil. Why going against Saddam Hussein and not North Korea?
Tell us how you heard about this event.
MoveOn.org, I think.
MoveOn.org. And your first name, ma'am?
Nancy.
Nancy, tell us what you think of this scheduled war.
I just think it's horrendous. It's terrible. If we were going to fight a war at all, we should fight a war against Saudi Arabia. They were the terrorists, not Iraq.
Elizabeth, tell us what you think.
Well, I agree with Carol, and I think that there are two things going on at the same time. It seems that they're trying to construct a rhetoric that's going to make everybody ready for war, but they're having to realize that people are not in agreement. So you read the paper, and you'll see two different stories simultaneously going on, one about how the administration thinks that we are going there and we need to be going to war, and the other part about how everybody who they need to support them disagrees with them.
Bush is drunk with arrogance. Is that your opinion?
Oh, certainly. He's been drunk with arrogance since his entire life.
Yes, I...
He's rising to the pinnacle today.
Yes, I saw an article, I think, in yesterday's New York Times that described George Bush in just those very terms, drunk with arrogance, drunk with greed. Heather, why? What brings you here?
We're here because we can't get to D.C., and we're in Houston, and Bush should know that the people in his own state do not want him to go to war against Iraq.
Yes, John, what brings you here today?
To protest against the war for a number of reasons.
Tell us some of those reasons.
I don't believe that that Saddam possesses weapons of mass destruction. I don't think he presents a threat to the United States of America. I believe it's about oil. And I don't believe that we have the money to spend against someone who's not an imminent threat, someone who we think has weapons or has the capability to have weapons that could reach the United States in a matter of months, when you have countries like North Korea, India, Pakistan that already have nuclear weapons, but we're not talking about attacking those countries. But the common factor being that Iraq has oil and those other countries don't.
I don't like this war thing. It's bad, like, because we don't need war for oil. It's all messed up.
The war on terror is the war on drugs in spades. Here's a story from Saturday's Guardian newspaper from the UK. Iraq, no nuclear evidence. It's a blow to U.S. hawks as inspectors draw a blank. They go on to say the United Nations nuclear inspectors will deliver a serious blow on Monday to Washington's case for going to war with Iraq, telling the world they have found nothing and giving Saddam Hussein good grades for cooperations. One more important story than our guests. This story is from Gustavo Legrief, who became Attorney General of Colombia at the height of the Medellin drug cartel's wave of violence and mass assassinations in the early 1990s. Legrief also had something to say on the subject of drug prohibition. This is a quote. It is incredible that in view of the failures in the war on drugs, its advocates continue to think that it is the best solution to the problems that drug consumption creates. This is due to the many political and economic interests involved in the continuation of a failed policy. The corrupt officers who profit from the war on drugs, of course, do not want to see the end of their dirty profits. The politicians who exploit the problems of drug consumption, picturing themselves as moral leaders of their communities, do not wish to end the problem. The governmental agencies with big budgets and large bureaucracies clearly would not want to see their source of income disappear, and so on. But I think this should not discourage us in claiming a better way of dealing with the problems that psychotropic and narcotic drugs create, for example, legalization. End quote. Okay, so I'm proud to introduce our first guest for the evening. He's a professor of law at South Texas College of Law and co-host of Houston's Access TV show, Drugs, Crime, and Politics, Buford Terrell. Welcome to Cultural Baggage.
Good to be here, Daniel.
Yes, sir. I consider this a big evening, and we're going to have a chance to have a law professor talk to Ed Rosenthal, and I'm just glad it's convenient that you're here.
He's right in the middle of a big legal mess in California.
Yes, he is, sir. Well, if you would, just tell us a bit about yourself, what it is you do.
Well, I teach at South Texas College of Law, and for about 4 years now, I have taught a seminar on controlled substances law.
Yes.
And in that, I have my students research various aspects of the drug law, write research papers on it. They spend a semester looking under the rocks, as it were.
Yes. And
they tend to find out, like most of us, that it's a big mess underneath and there's no justification for these laws.
Do many of them come to you with DARE training or a different look at it?
Well, I get a mixed bag. You know, the student body's really pretty conservative, and our school turns out a lot of future district attorneys.
Yes.
So, like most people, they think the law is good and should be upheld. By about halfway through the semester, they have discovered the federal government doesn't always tell the truth.
Yes.
By the end of the semester, most of them are in full agreement that dramatic changes are needed.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. They can at least the light dawns on them. You once indicated that we had about a 5-year window before marijuana would be regulated or
somehow truly controlled. Right. Mm. Well, what were the dates or where are we at on that?
I think I've got two more years on it.
I think you're probably about right then.
And it's beginning to look like I'm still right on track.
You see in the newspapers, every newspaper across America is talking about budget crunch, talking about the huge deficit that's just, you know, swarming over them like a tidal wave.
Right.
Would it not, you know, help our society if we could just back away from this drug war? How many billions do we spend?
Well, the estimate right now is about $20 billion a year at the federal level. There's probably twice that much with all of the states put together. And those are pretty much direct expenses. But if we take Texas with our budget crunch, we have a prison budget of about $2.5 billion with a B dollars a year. About 20 to 25% of the people in the Texas prison system are there for nonviolent drug offenses.
Well, I noticed there was a... it's been about almost a month ago, Houston Chronicle, front page, massive headlines, you know, people going to jail for minor amounts of drugs.
Over a third of those in the state jails, which is a maximum sentence of a year, but over a third of those were there for possession of less than a gram of a controlled substance.
Yes.
So we're not even talking major dealers. And even with Texas being low on the expense, it's about $12,000 to $15,000 a year for each prisoner kept in prison or state jail. So if you got rid of a third of those out of the state jails, massive budget savings.
I understand that, you know, there are efforts underway in Austin, talks with representatives, people thinking of presenting various bills. What have you heard, you know, that might be happening in the legislature?
Well, I know of at least four different approaches that are being talked about in Austin right now. The first one is a decriminalization of marijuana, which would reduce the penalty for possession of small amounts of marijuana from a misdemeanor with jail time to a fine like a traffic ticket. And, of course, that would cause quite a bit of savings. The second one is to follow the example of California and Arizona. And this is divert anyone convicted of drug crimes to a therapy regime rather than sending them to prison, at least for their first two convictions.
Yes, I can accept that with some misgivings, because I believe a person who, say for instance, is caught smoking marijuana very likely needs no treatment. But
probably, that's right. But as it works out under the California scheme, the judge refers them to a panel that determines how much therapy, if any, they need. Some of them can complete it in a week's time.
I once got busted in California, and this was 20 years ago, and they laughed at me in jail because I only had 2 ounces, and they wondered what the heck I was doing there.
Yeah, California had actually started down the decriminalization road with a bunch of other states in the middle 70s. So there are about a dozen states that already have some kind of marijuana decriminalization. So those are two of the things. The other two that I know of are more medically oriented. There's going to be an attempt once again for a medical marijuana bill, and one that probably, I can't release any names yet, but it looks like there's a senatorial sponsor for.
Wonderful.
Is one that that's being called prevention of HIV and hepatitis C, which in effect would allow for needle exchanges for cities or communities that want them.
Certainly a worthy endeavor, yes.
That one looks like a fairly good chance of passing.
Yes, sir. I mentioned your Access TV show. Tell us, tell the listeners out there what that is.
Okay, every other week, Al Robinson, who is the executive director of the Drug Policy Forum of Texas and a professor of pharmacology at the University of Texas Medical Center, and I spend an hour on Access Television interviewing someone somehow connected to the drugs, drug culture, or drug laws. It's a call-in show. Two of the ones I've enjoyed the most recently One has been with a woman who's a director of one of the local AIDS clinics.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about needle exchange. The other, a woman here who's a former parole officer and has started an organization that works with teenage children who have a parent in prison. And apparently that's the first program of its kind in the country.
Now, I'm always talking here on the show about critical mass. And by that, I mean the number and the level of importance of the people who are daring to stand up and say the emperor has no clothes. You know, what we already have governors, we got judges, we got legislators, active police officers, police chiefs, and maybe 70 or 80% of the population wants drug reform. And I'm just wondering, what level are we going to need to reach this critical mass to get the drug laws changed?
I think we may have reached it. Not this session of Congress, unfortunately. But one of the most telling things to me was that Time magazine issue, the 1st of November, where a serious, somewhat balanced study with medical marijuana on the front cover.
Yes.
When the mass media actually starts researching stories, presenting these as legitimate debates with balanced approaches, we're past the fear and superstition, and I think that the debate's going to heat up even more.
I think you're right. Now, we have these scandals here in Texas that just seem like stains that can't be washed off, that just grow bigger and bigger. I'm talking about the Sheetrock scandal in Dallas. I'm talking about Tulia, where there's still most of a dozen people in prison based on circumstantial evidence from an outlaw.
Well, let me correct you there. We don't have these scandals in Texas. We have those scandals anywhere, anytime there are prohibition laws. I might remind you that 75, 80 years ago, when we had alcohol prohibition, Elliot Ness and his group were known as the Untouchables because they were the only uncorrupt cops in Chicago. In 1999, at the National Association of Police Chiefs annual conference, their keynote speaker said that police corruption was the major problem facing police departments today. In California, in the past few years, we've had the big Rampart Division scandal in Los Angeles, the rioters in Oakland. Anytime you've got the kind of big money floating through a black market that you've got with prohibition, then part of that money is going to stick to police, judges, lawyers, prosecutors. I was noticing one story today that indicated that there were probably about 1,000 correction officials this year that will be facing corruption charges, smuggling drugs into prisons.
Like we could keep them out of prisons. You're right. We can't. How the heck are we going to keep them out of society? You know, you're absolutely right. If one pays attention, there are these corrupt, you know, cop stories coming down the pipe every day.
Yeah. Figure out a kilogram of cocaine is worth about $15,000 to $20,000. The average policeman makes maybe $35,000 a year. And if he sees a couple of bricks go through that he can divert without being caught, it's awfully tempting.
There's a year's
pay right there.
I want to alert the listeners that this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. We're here on KPFT Houston and on the Sirius Radio Network, channel 147. Our guest is Buford Terrell, professor at South Texas College of Law and co-host of the Access TV show Drugs, Crime, and Politics. We're going to bring on... got thrown for a loop here. Okay, we're going to bring in Ed Rosenthal here in just a minute. I'm told that the Internet is down. We can't get drug sense on the chat room tonight. I'm sorry, folks out there. But anyway, we want you to call in here in a little while. We'll get a chance to ask Ed and Buford some questions. But first off, I want to go ahead and they tell me we have Ed Rosenthal on the line. Let's go ahead and bring him in. Ed, are you there? Oh, hello, Ed.
Yes, I'm here.
Good evening, sir. How are you tonight?
Good. And yourself?
I'm well, sir. Big doings out there in California. We really want to hear what's going on. Could you tell us, you know, what's the latest? Where do we stand in the trial, sir?
Well, we're about, the prosecution is almost finished with its case. It will resume on Wednesday, and we think that it will be over, that their part of the case will be over by late Wednesday morning. And then we'll be putting on our case. And right now I'm charged with three charges, and that is possession of or cultivation of more than 100 plants, conspiracy to grow more than 1,000 plants, and maintaining a place where marijuana is grown.
Okay. Mr. Rosenthal, this is Buford Terrell. I'm a professor of law here in Houston and teach controlled substances law. And I was wondering, since I've been following the case, did they ever find a federal officer who could count up to 1,000 plants?
They have not been able to. And they haven't been able to find a federal officer that was able to count up to 100 plants.
That was what it was sounding like. From.
They did show in court, they showed this video of sort of a plant count, but the camera was jiggling all over, and there was no clear thing of whether they were counting the same plants or different plants. It was pretty, must have been pretty upsetting for the police.
Probably was. I would like to congratulate you, though, on your being able to even talk to us tonight. I was glad to see that the judge did refuse the request for a gag order on the case.
You know, I was all in favor of a gag order on the case.
So. You were?
Yes. Yeah. Because I thought the United States could do without some of the propaganda being put out by the DEA and by the other ONCDP and all of the other government agencies, and also about with some of the organizations supported by the government. So I felt that if we had a gag order, then that would be pretty good. You know, stop for all the government propaganda from going down. For instance, you know, the million or 3 million or whatever they're going to spend on the ads during the Super Bowl.
Right.
You know, don't you think it's kind of ironic? You know what these ads are going to say about these? It's these middle-aged people worrying about their teenage daughter having unprotected sex after smoking pot.
I think I would have heard that, yes.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual for the Bush administration to be talking about unprotected sex. They're trying to get rid of all kinds of sex education in the schools.
Yes, but consistency's never been their strong point.
No, it hasn't.
Ed, I understand that, you know, this is a change of attitude. This is a change of societal preference, I think, if you will, in California, that it is the will of the people out there. And what is the attitude? I mean, how are people taking this, the general public?
Well, first of all, everywhere I go, when people recognize me, they want to shake my hands. They tell me I'm a hero.
You are, sir.
That. Well, you know, I didn't volunteer for this. I was recruited for it. And so I perhaps have a little different attitude about that. But, you know, when the jury pool was called, and there were 52 people on the jury pool, and 20 of the people, the judge asked several questions about the issue. He said, does anybody have strong opinions about medical marijuana? And 20 people on the jury had strong opinions about it, and to such an extent that they felt they couldn't be impartial.
Yes.
And other people had strong opinions about it, but felt that they could be impartial. And there were only two people, in addition to the 20, there were two people who felt that marijuana should not be used as a medicine, and they were relieved. They were out. But we have a very good jury.
Yeah.
And we have there's a lot of understanding about this in California. And, you know, when the judge introduced the words medical marijuana, he was the first one to introduce those words.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, well, when he asked the jury whether anybody had a strong view about medical marijuana, he introduced the issue. And it's been there all the time. And, you know, we're not talking about whether marijuana is good medically. People have already decided that. The issue, you know, where he talked about deliveries being made to the harm reduction center.
Yes.
We talk about the judge asked a government witness, well, what's the difference between a clone and the finished product? And the government witness said, well, I buy the clones for $5 and sell them to patients for $10, and then the patients can grow their own medicine.
Okay. It sounds to me like the jury's hearing what they need to know.
That's right.
The ignorance from the other side, huh?
And I can only imagine, you know, with this judge, you know, people think Judge Breyer is a liberal judge, and because of the decision that he made in the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Club case. But his original decision was against the club. It was only when the Ninth Circuit sent it back to him for review that he changed his opinion, and then the Supreme Court upheld his original decision that medical marijuana wasn't couldn't be used as a necessity defense.
Right.
And this judge, I've been in federal cases before as an expert witness, and I've never seen a judge like this one. He does a lot of the questioning. He has utter contempt for the prosecutor and feels he could be a much better prosecutor. And so that basically he functions as both judge and prosecutor.
Uh-huh.
And the government could save so much money by just eliminating the prosecutor and just let the judge do it all. You know, it would be a real cost savings in this case. But in spite of that, it's all coming through, and the jury is going to we believe that by the end of the case, the jury is going to have full knowledge of everything that's going on.
Well, you've been around marijuana for a long time. How many books is it now?
About more than a dozen.
Yeah, and you had the column in High Time for years.
Yes.
Can you see a change in what's happening in this country as far as marijuana is concerned?
Yes. First of all, as far as medical marijuana, the majority of the country, the vast majority of the country, in favor of it. In California, it wins by higher percentages than any politician does. So I really think that that's happening, and I think it's happening all over. And I think that people realize that the laws, the marijuana laws, are more harmful to society than marijuana is. They're beginning to see it. They're seeing it when their kids lose the ability to have a scholarship or federal funds and things like that. It just affects people in many different ways.
Yes, Ed, are there ways that people can help in this effort? Maybe they could learn court dates to come to the courthouse or other ways that they could assist you, a website perhaps they could go to?
Yes, it's www.green-aid.com. And that's a nonprofit organization that is they're following the case very carefully, and they're funding a lot of my legal expenses. Because, you know, from the very beginning, we knew this was going to be a tipping point case and that it was going to have national implications.
You know, and I don't think most people realize how expensive federal litigation can be.
You know, it's sometimes when I'm working with my lawyers and I have a large legal team that are all working at very low rates. But even at those low rates, when there are four or five people in the room, and I imagine a taxi meter, and it's going at like, $10 a minute or something.
Yes.
$1 every 6 seconds. Boom, boom, boom. You know, it's just like you're driving along at some incredible speed in a taxi.
And the
meter is going. Somebody goes to the bathroom, we wait for a minute, that's $10.
Yes.
Okay. I want to alert the listeners out there, we will be taking a few calls a bit later. Our number here, 713-526-5738. We're here in the KPFT studios with Buford Terrell, professor of law, and we have on the phone Ed Rosenthal in California. Mr. Rosenthal, I see a number here that the fine, if you're convicted, would be $6.5 million?
I'm sorry?
I see a notation in a story I'm looking at here that if they were to convict you, the fine could be as much as $6.5 million.
Yes, and 20 years in jail.
That's just outrageous.
Yeah, it's really quite a, you know, what they're trying to paint me as is some drug kingpin. Basically, what I was doing was providing starter plants to the club so that patients could grow their own.
And hiding nothing from anybody, being endorsed by your local government, deputized, and yet sabotaged by our own government.
Well, the federal government doesn't accept it. There's a part of the drug code, Title 885D of Title USC. Title 18, and it was, and that's the part that exempts officers of the city, state, or federal government are engaging in narcotics, or controlled substances as a result of doing governmental work. And I was made an officer of the city of Oakland, and so that I could provide those services. And the city of Oakland recognized me. In fact, the assistant city attorney spoke at the hearing, testified at the hearing regarding that. And but the judge didn't accept it because she was not a federal officer.
Right.
But we have a affidavit and sworn testimony regarding a federal officer who did advise people, and we proffered that to the judge yesterday, and he's supposed to make a decision about it, because we feel that estoppel is a real issue here. And but as I said, we've had a judge who thinks he's a prosecutor, and professor, I've had this theory about American justice, that the problem with American justice is that the judges think that they're the prosecutors, and the prosecutors think that they're the judges, and if they could only get it right, we'd have a much better justice system.
Unfortunately, one of the things that happens is that a lot of the judges are prosecutors, and even in the federal courts, many times a U.S. attorney will be appointed to be a judge. And the result comes out much like what you're saying. I thought that I might take just a minute maybe to fill some of our non-California people in that California in 1996, I believe, by referendum adopted a law allowing people with doctor's advice to use marijuana for medical purposes, allowed their caretakers to provide it for them. And in trying to put this together and implement it, the city of Oakland worked with you and some other people to provide a means to get the plants to these people. The federal government, on the other hand, still claims that under the Controlled Substances Act, any possession or use of marijuana is illegal. And they're not allowing California to recognize an exemption. So is that pretty well the story for our listeners that may not be quite up to date?
Yes, that's what's going on. And what's happening is that, even as they're prosecuting me, there are perhaps 30 dispensaries in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's as if, in fact, one of the people who testified against me was given immunity so he would testify.
Yes.
And he himself is running a medical facility within walking distance, he testified, of the court. So when he left the courtroom, he was going back to the medical facility where that's open.
Okay. Wow. I wanted to just quote perhaps a friend of yours. I've spoken to him, Dale Gehringer.
Yes.
The head of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in California. And it's just a quote from him, just a short little statement. It was like a Moscow show trial. I think that perhaps sums it up.
Well, the judge, I think that the judge did not anticipate some of the things that were going to happen at the trial, and it's been much more open than the judge anticipated. So it's just that, you know, it's like trying to keep taking a cardboard box underwater and trying to keep it dry. It's just not going to work.
Right, right. The stuff just leaks out.
Leaks right in, right into the courtroom.
And one thing about the rules of evidence is good lawyers can almost always find some way to let the jury know what's happening.
But let me explain why the prosecutor went ballistic over what he called and wanted a gag order. You know, whenever you hear anti-drug propaganda, it's always the kids, the kids. What about the kids, right?
Right.
They always hear that. And so when people say, well, adults, yeah, but what about the kids? They always say that. So when the press photographed my daughter and myself together, and my daughter said to the press that my dad's a hero, and it was printed in the papers, they went ballistic. Because here is, you know, they thought kids were their province, and just the way the press picked it up, they just were very upset by it. And then, I don't know if you're aware of this, but this organization from New Jersey had been planning a billboard campaign here for several months.
Right.
It just came out. And on that billboard, they feature this young girl whose father was just given a 10-year sentence. She's an 8-year-old.
Right. I believe his trial was when, about 6 months ago.
The Brian Eppes, right?
That's right, Brian Eppes. And so between those two things, the prosecutor went ballistic the other day.
Well, I've noticed.
They don't like it being, you know, the truth about how kids are affected by pot, which is when their parents are taken away.
Right. But I've noticed that nationwide, the press, including a good story in the New York Times, has been very sympathetic to your case.
Well, you know, my case is when I say it's a black and white case, this is not a case of drug dealing. It's not a case where there's money laundering. There's nothing like that in this case. This is simply, am I going to be punished for helping to alleviate pain from patients?
Right.
That's what it comes down to.
It seems the only thing surreptitious about this was the government investigation, I would think.
They used some very shady characters. There's this guy who's been parading as a priest and actually trying to finance a quote monastery up in the country with profits from a club that he was associated with, and he was I believe that he was blackmailed into writing letters about me, and he was told what to write.
Okay, I want to stop here for just a second to tell folks you're listening to Culture Baggage on KPFT. Our guests are Buford Terrell and Ed Rosenthal. We want to take your calls. We do have some open lines. Our number, 713-526-5738. Steve, why don't we go ahead to a William there online?
Before you go ahead, I just want to mention one thing.
Yes, sir.
Which is that I am a host of a radio show called The 420 Report on KPFA here in Berkeley.
Well, wonderful news. That's music to my ear. I also do a show here on daily 420 drug war news on KPFT.
So, is that a daily show?
Yes, sir.
Wow. How long is it?
Oh, it's just a 3-minute news segment, but it comes on 420.
That sounds great.
Yes, okay. It's a lot of fun.
Yes.
Yes, sir. Do we have you online there, William? I'm sorry to hold.
Yeah,
sorry to keep you on hold for so long. Do you have a question, looks like, for Ed?
It's totally unrelated to the legal battle he's going through, but I have a neurological condition known as tardive dyskinesia, and I was wondering if he's had any anecdotal experience with helping people with similar conditions like Parkinson's
I don't personally. I'm more at the botanical end of it, but I do believe that with something like Parkinson's, you would do better with a plant that has quite a bit of CBD in it as well as THC,
right.
Combination. More like an indica type plant.
Right. One other question. You wouldn't happen to know, where I could find any information on treating such disorders with marijuana?
Check the net.
Okay.
Yep. You'll find quite a bit of information on the net regarding treating various diseases.
Okay.
Okay. Good luck.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you, William. We have another caller coming in. We do have some open lines, 713-526-5738. Buford, just gives us a little moment here to talk with Ed again. Ed, you know, I'm astounded that on the one hand, it can be so open, say, around Oakland or whatever, and yet they want to focus on you. Is it because you have been so outspoken? I mean, I can think of no other reason for this.
You know, I believe this was a selective prosecution. And I think that what happened was, Hutchinson was coming out here to speak.
Yes.
And he was going to speak at the Commonwealth Club, which people think of as a staid business person's club and so on. So they arrested me. I was going to be the trophy arrest that he was going to announce at the club, and he didn't realize that people had been alerted that he was coming to the club. So even beforehand, people had bought tickets for his speech, and by the time he gave the speech, he was confronted with it. But I was the trophy catch that he was going to announce during his cleanup of San Francisco.
Yeah, and of course, within the cannabis culture, you're a name of some note, so that there would be some effect of arresting you.
That's right. The idea was that if they can bring me down, then everybody better start running scared, run for the hills.
I think, from what, you know, little time I spent in San Francisco and Oakland, I mean, there's garden clubs out there that have now switched to teaching how to grow clones for patients and so forth. Right. It's a whole other place.
That's right. I mean, we have, you know, we have, first of all, can you imagine that the city government, the officers of the city government came and testified on my behalf. Now, that's not something that you would have all over the country.
No, certainly not. We do have some other callers. I can't see their names. Steve, you want to go ahead and punch up line one there? Okay, we're going to line two. All right, line two caller, would you want to give us your first name?
Hi, this is Stephanie. I'm currently a student of Tara Buford's controlled substance class.
Well, do you have a question for the professor or for Mr. Rosenthal?
I'd say this is for Mr. Rosenthal. It's a two-part question. First, I just want to ask, since you're in court every day and you're getting to look at the jury, do you think that your defense is currently going well? And do you feel that the prosecution, that the jury will buy what the prosecution is, you know, giving them? And, you know, if you feel that the prosecution perhaps, you know, towards the end, their case might be weakening, if they were to offer you a plea bargain, do you think that you might take it? And second question, do you think that if the current federal government were run under the Democrats, that maybe there wouldn't be such a push for the federal government to come after you for your actions?
Okay. Well, I want to take the second part first. When Clinton first came in office in 92, there were about 400,000 marijuana arrests every year. When he left office, there were close to about 750,000 arrests a year. So the Clinton administration was no great shakes for marijuana users. Secondly, Al Gore, you know, used to go to Grateful Dead concerts. He had the Grateful Dead in his when he was for dinner when he was vice president. Certainly, if you've gone to a Grateful Dead concert, you know what the major incense there is. He was familiar with marijuana, and he let that happen during the whole period of time that he was vice president. Now, when he was running for president, if he had said, well, I think we should investigate medical marijuana because there have been some reports, that would have been sort of a signal to a lot of people, right? And perhaps half of the Nader voters would have voted for Gore just based on those remarks. He lost the presidency through hubris and for having contempt for his own people. And so I'd rather have somebody who I know is against me and, you know what the score is than somebody who's, you know, half there and has to watch their back. So what was your first question?
My first question was, since, you know, those of us were not able to get the jury's reactions, and obviously you're in court every day, how do you feel that the case is currently progressing? And do you feel that if the prosecution believed that their case might not be as strong as, you know, closing arguments approach, and that they offered you a plea bargain, would you go ahead and take it, or are you going to fight this all the way?
Well, the question of being offered a plea bargain, I don't even want to approach that hypothetical because it's not on the horizon. And there's no way that the prosecution can afford to offer me a plea bargain. So that's number one. Now, as far as the case is going, the prosecution has had a number of witnesses, and they have not been able to get anything from any of the witnesses than that I provided marijuana to the medical clubs. And they feel that's enough to convict. And I don't think that is. And as far as the jury goes, this is an unusual jury. As I said, the first 20 people out of the 52 were recused for cause. That means because they had such strong opinions that they couldn't be impartial. And the jurors that are left, many of them still had strong opinions, but they felt that they could be impartial. And I think it's an excellent jury. Juries often see the truth even when it's not there.
Thank you, Stephanie. I want to go to our next caller. Steve, is nobody on three there? Okay. Oh, okay. All right. We do have open lines then. I saw a couple dropped off there, waited too long. I'm sorry about the delay. Go ahead, Buford.
I want to follow up on something Ed was just saying, and that's about the jury. This is really a classic case to see if a jury has a conscience, in that the federal statute read clearly is that there's no exception for medical marijuana. However, it's becoming more and more apparent that the only people that believe that are members of Congress. We all know what Mark Twain said about them. So the question is going to be here, what's the jury going to do when they're confronted with something they know is right and what something, on the other hand, the judge tells them is legal? And we're really back to that Peter Zenger case that we all studied in high school history about sometimes juries just tell the government to take a flying leap.
Well, I think it's beyond whether a jury has a conscience or not. This is very much a states' rights case. because I was led, and an estoppel case, because I was led to believe that what I was doing was perfectly legal. And I was led to believe that by government officials of the state and of the federal government. And then I was arrested for the very things that I was told were perfectly legal. And that's a clear estoppel. And as far as states' rights goes, once the state gave me, made me an officer of the city under 885D, Title 18 USC, it's not really legal for the federal government to be doing what it's doing. And unfortunately, they have the guns and the money, and I'm forced into this situation. But I think that with the jury as my judge, things will work out well.
I think you're right. Now, you know, Buford and I were talking earlier about the corruption. You know, my personal theory is it's the desired, scenario of the drug lords, that we have this corruption. We have gangs. We have, so many problems that the drug war creates, and it's exactly what they want. How can they stand and morally justify this when every report done outside the U.S. government says this stuff is not addictive, less dangerous than alcohol or tobacco, not a gateway? And yet, Hutchison and Asa Hutchison and John Walters stand up and lie every day, and the papers print it. I don't know. I'm just irate, Ed, I guess.
Well, what would you like me to answer there?
I don't know. I was just irate. I'm sorry. I just
well,
missed it.
Remember this.
Yes.
First of all, this is an unelected government.
Right.
That's
selected. Yes.
It's unelected government. It's a government of know-nothings. And it's a
retreads from the earlier Republican administrations.
Well, I think it's worse. I think that the earlier Bush had a certain sophistication and worldly knowledge that his son sorely lacks. I mean, just by calling France and Germany old Europe. I mean, can you imagine that?
Well, some of his retreads actually go back to the Nixon administration.
Yeah. But, I mean, to be calling people that, to be calling allies old fogies, so to speak. I mean, it's just... This is an administration which is going to begin the downfall of the American empire.
Okay, Ed, I think we have time for one more caller here. We have a gentleman out of Vancouver. That's John. John, you're on the line.
Hi, I'm John Gordon. Ed Rosenthal, I did a show with you on Pot TV, www.pottv.net.
Yes, yes.
I'm wondering, when John Walters came to Vancouver, he got a very bleak reception here, and actually when he came into the New Amsterdam Cafe, someone blew hash smoke in his face. I think that American policy gets a different view in the more liberalized Canada, and I'm wondering if in 6 months Canada legalizes marijuana, because it looks like the courts are going to insist on it, whether Parliament gets their act together or not. Will that help your case at all, or will there be any more freedom or any justice in the United States?
It's going to
be
very hard.
It's
going to be very hard for the U.S. government to explain why it's being so harsh when Canada has a different approach. But the United States already does that with weapons, with guns, for instance.
Well, I think there's something else here, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're talking about shutting down the border when it comes to, in fear of BC Bud when it's their cocaine that's coming into Canada.
Well, I was going to say that they've been trying to close the border with Mexico for decades now. They haven't been able to close it. The Canadian border is much longer, much more wide open, much more impossible to control.
They make it sound like our bud is invading them when more bud seems to come from Mexico. tons of it were found the other day.
Yeah.
I just want to say Wilson Paul is a hero in Canada as well as the United States. And
you betcha.
It was a pleasure meeting him when he was in Vancouver.
Well,
he's better received than John Walters.
Yeah, Ed, I met you briefly. I wanted to say your book signing and the display, just superb.
Chronicles. It's on cannabisculture.com in the bookstore there. It's about our event, about what it's like in the trenches here in British Columbia I don't know whether you guys are in the trenches or we are out here.
Well, you know, you have that great not really magazine, but it's sort of like a review of news up there, Pot Shots.
David Levine's got Pot Shots magazine, and I've got Flash's Chronicles, which is like fiction stories, but I call it true fiction, like the stories of the Western outlaws.
All right. That sounds great.
Well, I think the Canadians are a little bit ahead of us on actually instituting reform.
Well, John, I want to thank you. We're going to wrap it up here in just a couple of minutes. I appreciate the call.
All right. Thanks. Nice talking to you, Eddie Rosenthal.
Thank you.
All
right. Okay, Ed, I wanted to give you the opportunity to have an open mic here for a couple of minutes. What would you like to say tonight, sir?
Well, I really appreciate being on the show. First of all, I'd like to say how great it is to be on another Pacifica station. And
yes, sir.
How much, it's part of a great network. So that's number one. And I'm really thrilled to hear that you have a daily show at 4:20. And we're going to have to institute that right here in the Bay Area on KPFA.
Mine's got national stories if you're looking for a quick fix.
Right. Maybe we'll just carry your feed at 4:20, something like that.
Yes, sir.
You know, we have a great person on then, Waylon Southern. I'll speak with him about it.
All right. It's on my website, by the way. www.unvarnishedtruth.org, and people can listen to the 420s there. Just call them up on the web.
Great. And the other thing that I wanted to mention that is, if people want to follow my case, go to green-aid.com, and they have daily updates about what's going on. And it's a very exciting case. It's unfortunate that I'm the defendant, but if I wasn't the defendant, I'd tell you that this was a really exciting case with tremendous implications, and it's going to be a tipping point case that affects the way the federal government prosecutes marijuana. So please follow it, watch it. If anybody who can make a contribution to it, we really need help, because it's, as people know, legal expenses add up quickly. The taxi meter is running.
Taxi meter, you bet. Ed, thank you so much. We will certainly be reporting it on the Houston's 420 Drug War News, and we'll be, watching it close. And thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, and good night.
Good night.
Buford, I want to thank you for taking the time and staying up so late to visit with us here.
I'm happy to do it.
And we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. I think we got our closing and our credits, and I want to thank the listeners for joining us tonight. For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, The Unvarnished Truth.
If you would like to acquire a copy of any of the Cultural Baggage shows featuring judges, lawyers, doctors, pharmacologists, and many others for drug reform, please visit our website, unvarnishedtruth.org. If you have ideas on guests you would like to hear on Cultural Baggage, please send them to dean@cultural-baggage.com. Come on, let's end this crazy drug war.